thank you. Yeah, no, getting all the info.
The meeting will come to order. Members, will you please take your seats?
Thank you very much, Madam Chair and members. Appreciate you hearing this bill. It's House File 3386, and we are here, and this bill came out of a December 2007 Supreme Court case of Under the Rainbow Child Care Center versus the County of Goodhue. And this 4-3 Supreme Court case sent shockwaves throughout the 5,000 nonprofit organizations around this state. And nonprofits are property tax and sales tax exempt if, among other things, they meet the standard of being purely public charities. Now, there's always been somewhat undefined as to what that means. And so what that's been based off in the last, since 1975, was something called the North Star Standards. And in the North Star Standards, it was a list of six criteria that was developed actually on a Supreme Court case back in 1975 called the North Star Research Institute versus the County of Hennepin. And there were six criteria that they listed in that Supreme Court case. And it's been the assumption since 1975 that in looking at whether or not something is purely public charity and would qualify for the property tax and sales tax exemption, is they would kind of look at these six criteria collectively. And there wasn't any that weighed more than others, and assessors would kind of take a look at it and just kind of see it as a whole. Well, that kind of changed in December with the Rainbow case, because in the Rainbow case in that 4-3 decision, they said that basically if criteria number three, and let me read criteria number three, and I can read the other ones, but criteria number three, they said if this one's not met, it's not a purely public charity. It had, of those six, number three had to be met. And that one reads, whether the recipients of the charity are required to pay for the assistance received in whole or in part. Now, the Supreme Court said in this case that this really wasn't a change from earlier rulings. They had said in that case that they'd always basically come down to number three. Now, in dissenting opinion, the Supreme Court said, one of the quotes is, they disagreed with the strict application of just one of the six North Star standards. At any rate, what had gone from kind of collectively looking at these six North Star standards down to now just one's going to be the litmus test really created a great amount of uncertainty among the nonprofits throughout this state. And so that's why we're here today. And what this bill does is really just says, let's take a time out, let's step back from this, and let's take a year to look at what we can do to try to clarify this. So what the bill does is there is a study required and a report required to look at, you know, how can the Department of Revenue, nonprofits, assessors, how can they come together to take a look at how we define purely public charity. Besides the study and the report, there's also a prohibition. It says that it prohibits an assessor from changing any of its current practices or policies used in deciding whether or not something is purely public. It says also that assessment of existing property of an organization can't be changed unless it's made as a result of a change in ownership, occupancy, use of facility, property, market value change, and so forth. So what this bill does, it just takes a one-year break. There's a one-year moratorium so that assessors can't change their policy and practices when dealing with nonprofits to try to find out, you know, what are we going to use for criteria? Because in the past, we've looked at six criteria kind of collectively, and now the Supreme Court ruling says we need to look at just one. Now, some will say that's not a change. That's always been practiced that way. Nonprofits and others would say, hey, wait a minute, we've always kind of taken a look at everything. So with that, I have Marcia Abner, who's the Public Policy Director for the Minnesota Council of Nonprofits, and also John Hagen from the Department of Revenue to add a little more insight into all of this. So, Marcia?
Thank you very much, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Marcia Abner, and I'm the Public Policy Director at the Minnesota Council of Nonprofits. The Council of Nonprofits is a statewide association with almost 2,000 member organizations. We are very supportive of the author's amendment today, which does create the proposed moratorium. As a consequence of the Rainbow case, nonprofits and our legal counsel have been very concerned about the possibility of this being a more restrictive standard and making potentially a radical change in the way in which assessors look at nonprofits. Some of the organizations that have already been approached by assessors, and I learned this from an elected official, a member of the legislature, include developmental achievement centers. We've also heard from children's mental health centers, community mental health centers. Some of the very organizations that I think many Minnesotans would agree are providing a public benefit really need kind of the protection of a somewhat broader look at the criteria. One of the criteria that's been used in the six-point standard applied through the North Star test and the playing out of the North Star test in case law has been, does the work of the nonprofit alleviate the burdens of government? And that, for instance, is one of the criteria that we think should be back in consideration. But what we've done at this point is, based on the concerns of many of our nonprofit members and others, we began a rapid response of meetings with the Department of Revenue and with assessors. Those have been very productive discussions. We are very pleased with the commitment that we have in the period of a moratorium to look carefully at what will really be the first codification of standards for determining property tax exemption for 501c3 nonprofits that meet the public purpose test, the public charity test. We've always dealt with this in case law. As Representative Marquardt has pointed out, that has not always been fully satisfactory, but it has been broader. And so we are very hopeful. We already have a plan for the beginning of our discussions. We've had three pretty intensive meetings already, and we hope that you will support the moratorium. We think it will give us time to do something deliberative and productive to bring back to you in 2009.
Thank you. Madam Chairman, my name is John Hagan. I'm Assistant Director of the Property Tax Division. Thank you and the members of the committee for allowing me to speak on behalf of House File 3386 that, as Representative Marquardt mentioned, provides for a temporary moratorium on the assessment of institutions through the public charity. Representative Marquardt mentioned that it would be it would apply to all institutions of purely public charity currently exempted or taxed, depending on what their tax status is, and there would be an allowance for changes in ownership, changes of use, or changes in occupancy of the property. We would, however, recognize that in the event of a moratorium, we'd have to find a way to deal with newly formed, newly constructed, or newly acquired institutions of purely public charity that would have to be dealt with. And to deal with that, we're proposing putting together a review committee composed of Department of Revenue staff, members of the Minnesota Association of Assessing Officers, and representatives of nonprofits, Minnesota Council of Nonprofits, to try to look at those properties individually and make a determination on the appropriateness of their tax status. If in the event of a moratorium, we'd instruct all county assessors to provide us with applications and all the documentary evidence that they would want to submit to us, and we'd make a determination on all properties that had been, that were new coming onto the tax rolls or off the tax rolls for that matter, any newly acquired or changed properties. We do believe it's extremely important for the property tax administrators as well as all institutions of purely public charity to have clear and understandable guidelines of what does and does not qualify for exemption. We believe it's imperative that properties are treated similarly from one jurisdiction to another, and that they can depend on either their tax status or non-tax status, not changing from one year to the next. Something we've heard a lot in our conversations with the Minnesota nonprofits is it's so important to the nonprofits to be able to depend on what's going to happen now and into the future. The Department of Revenue, the Minnesota Association of Assessing Officers, Minnesota Council of Nonprofits, and a number of other shareholder groups, including the Minnesota Health and Housing Alliance, have all agreed with us. We're all in agreement that we don't want the universe to change. We don't really want to expand the number of nonprofits, and we don't want to contract that number either. Having said that, we do expect and we do realize that we will, in the course of our work, identify some properties that are likely currently taxed that should not be, or conversely currently exempted that should not be. So we do expect a small change, but nothing of any major proportions. The group that Ms. Abner referred to that we're forming, and I believe our first meeting is tentatively scheduled for April 17th, that's sort of a meeting to try to figure out how we're going to operate, will be charged with the developing clear guidelines for what qualifies an exemption of institution, what qualifies for exemption as an institution of purely public charity, and will be composed of representatives, as I mentioned, of the Department of Revenue, House and Senate staff, and representatives of the assessment community. I'm very optimistic and pleased that we're taking this collaborative approach and trying to deal with this very real problem. And look forward to your support.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Marquardt and testifiers. We do have a quorum now. Would you like to move your bill?
I would. I would like to, thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to move House File 3386 for possible inclusion into a property tax bill.
And would you like to go ahead and move your amendment as well?
And I also would like this time like to move the DE1 amendment.
Thank you. All in favor of those that would like to incorporate the author's amendment into the bill, say aye.
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 Those opposed, same sign. The amendment is adopted. Representative Tamar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a couple of questions. In the Rainbow decision, was it just property taxes that was the issue of nonprofit exemption, or was sales taxes included? I'm not sure who I was asking. Whatever.
It is a property tax decision. It does have implications for the sales tax for nonprofits, in that if you lose your property tax exemption, you are likely to lose your sales tax exemption. And that's, I think, the position of the department.
And either Ms. Abner or Marquardt, I'm sorry, Madam Chair. How do we compare with other states regarding language on what constitutes a nonprofit?
Very good. Representative Tamar, I think I'll let Ms. Abner answer that one.
We are curious about that as well. And in speaking with House and Senate staff, they have actually suggested that we not spend too much time on those comparisons because the states are so different. But the national director of the National Council of Nonprofit Associations was here in Minnesota and is very clear that in looking across the state, it makes Minnesota probably the most restrictive state, the court ruling does, and that the nation really is watching what happens here because this would be so restrictive that it would essentially set a different standard than most people expect in their state. So we will be looking at other states. What we do know is the perception in the national community of nonprofits is this would make Minnesota what they consider a dangerously restrictive state.
Final question, Madam Chair. I'm just looking at Section 1, Subdivision 2 in your this report to the commission. I'm trying to get, maybe this is for the Department of Revenue, but the working group or the group that you're talking about organizing, where is that in the bill? And you don't really have, if I'm reading the bill, and I think this is a good compromise to sort this all out, but I don't see like a composition of the working group or any language like you would normally find. And Ms. Abner, if you're satisfied with that, I guess I'd be fine with it too. But usually when you construct a working group, it spells out who will be part of that entity.
Madam Chair, Representative Tamar, we are very comfortable with the position that this would place us in. We've had really productive, lengthy, well-attended, fully participatory discussions with the department and with the assessors. The language here was modeled after other moratorium language relating to other issues. And we feel very comfortable with a starting date, actually a continuation date of our discussions, that there really is a deep commitment here to continue this work in a collaborative way. We're committed to it. The department has been clearly committed to that. The assessors have been enthusiastically committed to it. And so we are, in fact, comfortable with this language.
Thank you.
Are there other questions? Are there any testifiers from the audience? Representative Marquardt would like to make any closing comments.
Well, thank you very much, Madam Chair and members. This is an important item, and just even the Representative Tamar's questions, it did deal with property taxes because the Supreme Court in this Rainbow case did reverse the tax court who had ruled in favor of the Rainbow Bridge. But this is, we need some clarity on this because this really throws up in the air kind of nonprofits wondering what's going to happen as far as their tax exempt status. So I would renew House File 3386.
And House File 3386 will be laid over for possible inclusion in the committee report.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Representative Brown, for sharing. And while we have a quorum here, I'd like to approve the minutes. We have March 7th minutes, and Representative Dietrich moves the March 7th minutes. Any discussion on that? If not, all those in favor of those minutes, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, say nay. Motion carries. The next area we have, and I would ask the commissioner to come down if he would, is today we're going to talk about the property tax implications of the governor's proposal, and we're only going to deal with those property tax provisions. There is, I think it's Monday, that the tax committee is going to be hearing the other area. So we're going to find out there's about three main areas that really deal with property taxes that we will be looking at. And as far as any testimony, I guess we'll see if we have some time at the end. Otherwise, Chair Lincheski has said there will be testimony available on the entire tax bill on Monday. So I'm not really looking for testimony today. It's kind of discussion of the committee and so forth. And welcome Commissioner Innes and Mr. Manson for being here. And before we start, I first of all, you know, everyone has looked at this part as far as the property tax, and I do appreciate that the governor did not take another hit at local government aid or county program aid. I really do appreciate that. And I do think that an effective case has been made by our mayors and city council members and commissioners that local government aid and county program aid does provide property tax relief and does fund important services. So I thank the governor for that understanding. And you know, of course, that's some of the areas we looked at first. And also, as I look through it, the market value homestead credit is held whole. The homeowners property tax refund program is held whole, which we've talked a lot about, and you've done great work in promoting that this year, and also the targeting program. So I think there's really about three areas that we'll be talking about: the levy limits, the utility transition aid, and the renter's property tax credit. I think those members are probably the main three areas. There's some other ones that I know going to some school districts. I know the utility part, I don't know if we'll deal with that. But so I think we're looking at sections 9 through 14 of the bill, section 33 and section 49.
Yep.
Somewhere might be other ones. So with that, Commissioner, or yes, Representative Tamar.
Do we have a bill, or are we just looking at
this? We do not have a bill, I don't believe. No, we don't have a bill, so we're working off of, do they have this, I think this 2008 governor's tax bill summary is what we're doing on there. So, Commissioner Innes, thank you so much for being here.
Chairman, member of the committee, my name is Ward Innes, representing the Department of Revenue. Jack Manson, Assistant Commissioner of the Department of Revenue. And you were correct, Chairman, those are the three issues kind of within the purview of this committee in the governor's supplemental budget. And I'll walk through them and kind of how they appear in the bill, even though the bill's not in front of you. And as the chairman said, sections 9 through 14 are the levy limits. Is the levy limit proposal the governor's recommending? And in many respects, it's similar to traditional levy limits with a couple of noteworthy distinctions. It would apply to communities of 2,500 or more. So about 244 cities, I believe, all 87 counties would come under the this proposed levy limit. It would include all the special levies that have currently been under the traditional levy limit. I think there's 13 different special levies that are exempt from the levy limit cap. Those would stay in place. There'd still be the general law provision where if you wanted to exceed the levy limit cap, you could take it to a referendum and get voter approval to exceed the cap. But the primary distinction from this and traditional levy limit cap is that the inflation factor would still allow for household growth, and the inflation factor is the lesser of 3% of inflation. And in the past, it's been household growth plus CPI. So that's a little bit of a change in that methodology. In addition, the levy limit base is not levy plus aid, it's simply levy. And the reason for that change was that the governor's focus really was on taxpayers. And in the traditional levy limits, when you had the levy limit base was levy plus aid, kind of had disparate treatment between aid-dependent cities and cities that weren't aid-dependent. This put the taxpayer on even playing field. So no matter if you're a resident of an aid-dependent city or not an aid-dependent city, you'll be treated in a like manner under this levy limit. We did a run to determine what this impact this would have had if it's been in effect for taxes payable in 2008. And if this levy limit had been into effect, we would have seen about $128 million reduction in property taxes. Put that in context, the increase was 7.3%. This would reduce that increase to 5.4% on a statewide basis. And so that's essentially it's a permanent levy limit, it's not temporary under the proposal. Chairman, to walk through three and then still
let's do it this way. If you have any technical questions as far as the wording, ask it at this time, and then he can go through that. Otherwise, then we'll come back and take one at a time for questions and discussion.
Fair enough, Chairman. Fair enough.
I had one question on the levy limits. Isn't it the lesser of 3% or the implicit price deflator rather than consumer price index?
Right, it is implicit price deflator. I think consumer price index.
I think might be in the revenue summary. And this, there's a difference there because I think the consumer price index is about 3.7, where the implicit price deflator is about 5.45, and that tends to be a more accurate indicator of the actual cost of goods to local units of government.
I'm sorry, I've just been corrected by Eric Ouellette that it is in fact CPI. It's the lesser of 3% or CPI.
You're
absolutely right. Our revenue estimate here does show that
Commissioner, that wording that I took off the internet of Representative Simpson's bill, which was introduced just the other day, and on 17.26 it says the percentage growth and the implicit price deflator. Now, I don't know.
Okay. Yeah. We got a little disconnect here between our revenue estimate that we did for this bill and actually the bill language. And you're absolutely right, Chairman. The bill language is a implicit price deflator. Mm-hmm. And it looks like in our revenue estimate we're talking about CPI, which was 3.7%. So.
And I guess that. I just wanted to make clear that I'll come back and ask a question later. So, but it is implicit price deflator in the language.
I'm going to defer to the language.
Okay,
that's probably the accurate way we want to go with it.
Very good.
I'm going to defer to the bill language. Okay, the revenue estimate.
Members, any other questions on the levy limits? Just on the technical part, we'll come back and make comments. But all right, Commissioner, if you move to the next area, please.
Sections 33 and 34 are an adjustment in the renter's credit. And in 1997, we changed the methodology for doing the renter's credit. It went to a statutorily presumed percent of rent. And at that point, it was 18%. I think in 98, it was increased to 19%. And in the last 10 years, it's been at 19%. And in 2005, the Department of Revenue issued a report to kind of revisit to see if 19% actually was the appropriate percentage to be at. And that report concluded that 19% was probably too high, and that the appropriate percentage is probably closer to 15%. So this recommendation here is predicated on the findings of that report. And I think the major intervening event that occurred between 98 and today was, of course, the 2001 property tax reform. And pursuant to those reforms, I think apartment properties saw about 24% reduction in their property tax burden, but we never recalibrated the renter's credit. So the renter's credit stayed at 19% when the finances report, and we did three different, the apartment did three different data sets when they did this report. One was a survey we sent out to landlords, and that found that the statewide average was about 12%. And then we did one that was based on Census Bureau information, and that was about 13%. And then we did one with a little bit different subset with MHFA, so it was rent subsidized, low-income housing, and that was actually below 10%. And we also found, this report also found that about 91% of all the properties were at 15% or less. And so we think this is a reasonable recalibration of the renter's credit in light of the report that the department did in 2005, and in light of the fact that they did sustain substantial property tax deductions in, under the 2001 reform. And that raises about, I think each percentage point reduction about $11 million a year. And then the final recommendation the governor has related to property taxes is section
49-1551.
And you're all very familiar, I think, with this recommendation because it was in last year's governor's recommendation. In this regards, the replacement aid, the transition, we call it the transition replacement aid for those cities that were disproportionately impacted by the utility valuation rule. So this is the governor's way of trying to provide some sort of shock absorber to those communities that were disproportionately impacted by the utility valuation rule. And if you remember, the utility valuation rule has a phase-in. We phase that rule in to try to mitigate the impact of that rule. In addition, now we're providing some transition aid, temporary transition aid, to those communities that we deem probably the most impacted by it. And the threshold was, if you were a community that had more than 5% of net tax capacity reduced under the rule, you would be eligible for this replacement aid. It's a two-year replacement aid, and we think it provides a shock absorber to those communities so they can adjust their revenue. Oh, the one exception to that, one exception to that is Red Wing, because there's language in the bill that says if you have an agreement with the utility, you're not eligible for this replacement.
Any questions for the commissioner or Mr. Manson?
Representative Paymar. Well, I just want to be clear about the changes that you're making in the renters' property taxes. So, if I'm reading this correctly, what percentage of renters would see a reduction in their property tax refund?
I think all renters, people currently receive a renter's credit, would see a reduction. And I think the average refund change, if we would be about $119 per refund would be the change. Currently, the average refund is
$584 currently, and it would go down to $465. So that is about $119 reduction on average.
And
Representative Paymar,
Chair, I'm just trying to these are tough economic times for everybody, Is any of this means-based, or is this that all renters would see a reduction? And I'm just thinking there are a lot of low-income renters and all through the state that are going to be hurt by this reduction. And
let me toss that question to Eric Ouellette. My understanding is about a 20% reduction in the renter's credit. We go from 19 to 16%.
I think Mr. Chairman and Representative Paymar, I think it would impact all renters that currently qualify, because this is income tested for renters. So anybody that qualifies now would see a reduction, and some actual renters would actually not get a refund at all. So it would impact anybody currently in the program.
Representative
Paymar.
And why did you say you're doing this again?
Commissioner Einhorn. And I'll tell you what, since we're on here, we'll make this the discussion part on the renter's credit. So we'll just go take this topic first. So,
Chairman, Representative Paymar, we're trying to reestablish what we thought was the original intent of renter's credit, which is really to serve the property tax relief program. I think since we haven't recalibrated that percentage in over a decade, it's become kind of a hybrid. It's become private tax bill, but also rent subsidy, because there's a disconnect between what really is just the amount of private tax that are being paid by these renters and the level of the renter's credit. So the reporting has concluded that for a lot of individuals who receive this, it's not pure property tax relief program anymore. It's become, it's morphed into a somewhat of a rent subsidy. And we just think we should reestablish the original intent of the program, which was to be property tax relief program. There may be a very legitimate reason for doing rent subsidies. I'm not sure the PCI, the renter's credit, is the appropriate vehicle for that.
Representative Wassler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to our guests. This is, as you know, an area of significant interest to me. Over the last 5 years, the largest increase in any property type in property taxes has been the non-homestead residential, the one to three-unit sizes. So they've been really hit hard. I've had them show up at my town meetings, the property owners and their tenants. And I noticed on page 4 of the analysis, if you look at that...
Representative Wofford, would you get us there so we can all take
yes, it look? Yes, it says property tax is a percentage of residential rent.
Is that the study? Looks
that's
like the study.
Study.
Very good.
Mm-hmm. If you look on page 4, you will note that on the 1-3 units, statewide it's 18%. It ranges from 16.6% non-metro, other metro, 21%. In the cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul, it's about 18% and 19%. So it looks like, at least for the people who live in the 5,000 duplexes in my district and those that are scattered throughout the metro area, that they actually would not even be getting fair credit under the proposal. Is that correct?
Commissioner?
Yes, Chairman, Representative Laffer, there, based on that sampling, this sampling was, I think it was a fairly representative sampling. We sent out, I think, about 58,000 requests for information from landlords. I think we got back about 7,200 usable surveys, something in that ballpark. So that, this information here is premised on that. You know, I think that's the rub with any time you put a statutory presumed rent number in the statute, that there's going to be some outliers, depending on the size of the property and such, that may not fall within that presumed rent. But if you look at the statewide average for all units, which this is a program that's trying to, you know, serve all units, it's less than 12%. So going to 16%, we think it's still well above what the average is statewide. And it is, as the other information says, 91% of the properties fall within that band. So we think that's appropriate. I mean, the other option is to go back to what we did pre-97 and just base it exactly on what the landlord would have to apportion it to the tenants, what they paid in rent that was attributable to property taxes. It was administratively burdensome. It was administratively burdensome for landlords, but it was accurate. And we knew exactly what each unit was paying. I would say under that proposal, there'd be far more losers than there would be winners if we went back to that way of doing it. But it would reestablish the program for what it was originally intended to be, a property tax relief program. So I stipulate there will be some individuals that if you reduce that renter's credit, even 1%, that's probably going to be adverse, and there's always outliers. But for the vast majority of renters, it's a fair place to
Representative Wofford.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I actually think, though, that we have an obligation to look at equity. And, you know, over the last few years, you know, we've seen increases of less than 5% generally in the large apartment buildings, with dramatic increases with the small ones. And now it looks to me like if you're in a larger unit, you're probably going to come out okay on this one. But if in a smaller unit, which is already suffering the higher taxes, you're actually going to be under-recognized. And I think this is a time for us to kind of look at the whole rental class and see what really is fair. And I think part of it goes back to the assessment practices. Large buildings tend to be rent capitalization in terms of establishing value. Small buildings tend to be comparable sales. A lot of times, you know, they're mixed in with owner-occupied small buildings, with not. It's just a very different market, and I think we're going to need to get as sophisticated in this part of our property taxes as we do in some of the other areas. So this is an area I'm hoping that I'll have a chance to work with others on.
Thank you, Representative Wofford. I think that's a great point, and I think the governor's proposal maybe opens us up to take a look at it, too. Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to clarify, the $33 million reduction in credits paid, does that include Section 34 as well, or only 33?
I think that's both.
Commissioner?
That's both sections. Okay. Chairman, Representative Lanning, that's both sections.
Thank you.
Any other comments on this portion of Governor's property tax proposals? And I, you know, as Representative Lofler brings up and as the Governor brings up here, you know, I think it is an area that we need to take a look at, because the integrity of any program is if it's doing what it's supposed to be doing, and not any more and not any less. And I think even with local government aid, I think, and I know there's a lot that were against this, but when you move from basically a grandfather system to one based almost entirely on factors and need, I think it added more integrity to local government aid. It was doing what it was supposed to be doing. It wasn't based on factors unrelated to, you know, need and so forth. So I think as we look at all these programs, the more we can, you know, and I think that's maybe what this could open up to be. So any other comments on that? If not, let's move to the utility transition aid portion. Any questions from members? I'm sorry, Representative Earhart.
Mr. Chairman, don't we already have a step rate to help the cities that isn't it a step situation now? Is this in addition to, or?
Commissioner?
Chairman, Representative Earhart, you're correct that the utility valuation rule that's being implemented is phased in for a number of years in order to try to mitigate the impact on those host communities. This is in addition to that. I think that we've had a lot of discussion about the impact this utility valuation rule is going to have on communities. And so we thought maybe the phase in the rule wasn't enough in and of itself. So we've also come up with some transition aid. And this just goes to those communities that we felt were most disproportionately impacted by the rule change. They had to have lost at least 5% of their net tax capacity. But it doesn't go to the whole universe of host communities. This goes to those that have lost at least 5% of their net tax capacity due to the rule change. So it is in addition to the phase, correct?
Well, Mr. Chairman, the pipelines also got hit with the utility increase. What are you doing for them?
Commissioner Reines?
Well, Chairman, Representative Earhart, I mean, the pipelines, I think, their primary concerns, they don't want to see a class rate increase on them, as it did with other utilities. So I think, you know, we are not opposing that, obviously, and that's been a point of contention between the governor and the legislature. We thought this was maybe a middle ground, provide some transition aid to those communities most impacted. That combined with the phasing of the rule, I think the pipelines are supportive of the governor's recommendation here. You could ask them, but I'm pretty confident they're supportive of this approach.
But, Mr. Chairman, they're not getting any change. They're going to remain the same at with the higher rate that the
No, they will, Chairman, Representative Earhart, the pipelines, they basically status quo under the rule. They'll get the benefit of any valuation change that comes pursuant to the rule, and this proposal does not recommend a class rate increase. So under this proposal, they would see no change other than the benefit they receive from the rule change.
Maybe I misunderstand. Are you proposing that the rate be increased on utilities here?
We are, Chairman, Representative, we are not. We are proposing no change in the class rate that applies to the utilities, pipelines or the utilities. We think the rule should go into effect. We think the rule should go into effect in a phased-in way to limit the immediate impacts. And then we're providing the two-year transitional aid to those communities in order to help them absorb the change due to the rule. So there's no change in the tax class rate that's applied to utilities in this proposal.
Thank you.
You know, on this proposal, of course, we've had the debate on moving up the class rate, and when you move up the class rate, you rise all boats. So then, you know, all the communities, whether or not it's 5% on tax capacity or whatever, you help everyone, and I tend to like that better. But I mean, we're making an attempt to hit those that are hit the worst. But you know, there still are going to be, you know, like counties. None of the counties will qualify for this aid, and yet, you know, Goodhue is going to lose about $1.2 million in revenue, and Sherburn County about $1.6 million. And you know, we know the squeeze that's being put on counties and local units of government right now is, you know, counties are really getting hit with the Federal Deficit Reduction Act and targeted case management. And
yeah.
And I mean, I'm just wondering if there's some hybrid here that we could work, because, oh, and even, you know, if you go to cities and that, it, you know, might, you know, I've got City of Burnsville, they're going to lose about $257,000. I'm taking some of the big losers, of course, out of here. In Inver Grove Heights, $154,000 of revenue. And in this time where, you know, you've seen increasing property taxes and times are tight, I mean, this is going to be, this is going to put a squeeze on a lot of these communities. And I'm just wondering if you would be open at all to something else where you could kind of get to everyone and at least raise them up, because, you know, I mean, it doesn't look like the class rate increase is going to fly. But I'm just wondering if there's another approach to somehow rise all boats and so forth. Commissioner?
Well, Chairman, you know, I expect we're going to have a very robust discussion on this issue. It's an important one. Due to, you know, this financial constraint, we weren't able to do a broader transitional aid because it is going to be cost prohibitive to pay for that. I think our primary concern is that a permanent class rate increase on that class of property is not, in our mind, the preferred route to go. Now, we're willing to entertain other options. There's a hybrid out there that may get us where we need to go, that maybe has a little broader footprint than even the proposal that we're putting forward here. We'll be more than willing to look at that, Chairman. I think our biggest concern is having a permanent class rate increase to deal with what we think, and this is more of a, you know, a temporary disruption until they acclimate to a change. But we're willing to look at it, and I think we can hopefully find some middle ground where we can mitigate the impact, but also not put an undue burden on the utilities.
Very good.
You know, just to elaborate, you know, these taxpayers, like any taxpayer, exercised their right to challenge the valuation methodology, and they were successful. They were right. The rule we had in place for the last 20 years was legally deficient. So we went, you know, with all the stakeholders in, put together a new valuation rule, took it to an ALJ. The ALJ approved that rule. We understood this would have an impact. We proposed a phase in the rule. The ALJ approved that. And so, you know, I think we've done what we can to do due diligence to put a rule out there that passes legal muster, that is a vast improvement over the previous rule. And there's something, I don't know, I don't want to be unfair, maybe too strong a word, but taxpayers are exercising their right to challenge evaluation, and the legislature turning around, well, you were right, you succeeded on the merits to challenge evaluation methodology, but we're going to put a class rate increase on you. So it's, you know, basically a wash. And so I just think that's a question whether that's appropriate, that's the right approach. Maybe something temporary, something that has a broader footprint than what we're proposing, we can find a way to get in there. I hope so, Chairman.
Any other comments on this portion? Representative Lanny.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm looking at this table that shows the utility valuation rule and the proposed replacement aid. I'm wondering if somebody could clarify and explain that. there are some aspects of it that I'm not sure I'm following correctly here. So,
Representative Lanning, what sheet are you on, just so everyone can be on? Okay, very good.
It's called the Governor's 2008 Supplemental Budget Utility Evaluation Rule Proposed Replacement Aid.
And this is the front of it. Here, so.
Oh.
A little pack. Thank you.
And so the question is, the column that estimated state aid payment, is this the payment that those communities would receive over what time frame?
That is correct. I don't have the exact same document you have, but maybe I do now.
Yeah.
Yeah. That last column is the amount they received they will receive in FY11. So when the transition aid is fully phased in, the rules phased in, the impact of the rules will be phased in the transition aid as well. And so in FY11, all the communities that are eligible for this will receive a little over $1.5 million. And that last column is their respective share of that 1.5. And if you see 9 cities, that would be eligible in 22 towns.
Thanks. Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Will they receive a payment then in 09 and 010? That's being phased in, or is it just a one-time payment? I'm not sure about
it. Chairman, Representative Lanning, it will be payments just for 2 years. The first year in FY10, they will receive $764,000, that group of cities and towns. And then in FY11, they will receive about $1.5 million, and then they won't receive anything thereafter. So it is a transition aid program for a two-year period.
Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So the last column, state aid column, in 010 they would get 50% of that amount, and in 011 they'd get the full amount, and after 011 it goes away.
Commissioner Ryan.
Chairman, Representative Lanning, you're absolutely right. Correct.
And then one last question, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Lanning.
Where it says Red Wing City is Red Wing excluded, does that mean that they don't meet these caps?
Commissioner?
Chairman, Representative Lanning, they meet the eligibility requirements except the fact that there's language in the bill that says if you've entered into agreement with the utility, we call it a hold harmless agreement, that may be overstating it, I don't think it holds them completely harmless, but they've entered into a contract with the utility. If you have an agreement like that, with the host community has an agreement, then you're not eligible for this.
Okay.
Placement.
Thank you.
Thank you. And my understanding of the agreement, which I've read between, was it XL Energy and Red Wing, is that whatever revenues that XL is paying the city of Red Wing in the year before the changes go into place, that's what they're going to keep. So gradually over time, it certainly would lose it. Initially, it would hold, it would provide some revenues anyway, but I think that's generally what's in that agreement. Commissioner, are you more familiar with that?
I believe that's correct, and I think is it for a 10-year period?
I believe it is.
10-year time period?
Okay. Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner. I'm just still trying to understand this, and it looks like on page 2 of the same document, it says page 243, it's actually a couple of pages in, it says there's a utility transition aid for schools. And, is the general effect of your proposal matching the phase-in of this is to make cities, towns, and schools essentially whole or just to replace parts? Mm-hmm. And am I correct in understanding the earlier discussion with the chairman that there's nothing for the counties?
Commissioner?
Chairman, Representative Loeffler, that's correct. None of the counties meet the 5% tax capacity loss threshold in order to be eligible for this. It does not hold them harmless. It holds them harmless for any amount of tax capacity they lose above the 5% threshold. I stand corrected. The 5% above levy plus aid. So if they lose anything above that, we replace dollar for dollar. So it doesn't hold them completely harmless. It holds them harmless above that minimum threshold.
Any follow-up, Representative?
Oh, thank you.
Okay. Anything else on this part?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Earhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So if I understand this, then we're going to pay for the utility transition aid partially out of eliminating the political contribution refund.
Commissioner Kynes, that is outside that portion, though, but he did relate it in there, so you're required to answer that question. Commissioner.
I will answer it. Chairman Representative Earhart, I wouldn't make that causal relationship. I don't think there's a lot of upticks in the supplemental budget and downticks as far as revenue. I would not make that connection. We just think the governor is very cognizant of this debate in the legislature about this utility valuation rule, and we've talked with him numerous times, and he wanted to find a fiscally responsible way to try to address this issue without permanently disrupting, increasing tax burden for utilities.
Well,
PCI is a constituent outside my domain.
Representative Earhart, that last question was ruled germane by the chair, so you may proceed.
I was just wondering, Mr. Chairman, could we just pass the hat among the legislators and then help?
All right. Any other questions or comments on the utility transition? If not, we're going to move to the levy limits. We got a full 35 minutes to talk about levy limits. And as the commissioner had mentioned, there are a few differences in what has normally probably been levy limits, and that is that rather than putting the limit on levy plus 8, it's only on levy. And then also it is a lesser of either 3% or implicit price deflator. So those are, Commissioner, would you agree those are maybe some of the differences, major ones between past levy limits?
Chairman, I would agree. That's probably the only two substantive differences in what traditionally has been our levy limits. Right.
Members, I have put in your packets a sheet here, and I want to make sure the commissioner gets this also. It's the impact of governor's levy limits on selected cities. And what I did is I took a look at how when you only put the levy limit on levy, how it impacts cities that also receive local government aid. And the difference between that and putting a levy amount on levy plus aid. Because I think we could all argue that, for the most part, most of a city's revenue or budget, probably 90%, everything being equal, is going to come in through levy plus aid. Now, you've got court fines that would come in, rental of community center, and that type of thing. But everything being equal, the bulk of a budget would be levy plus aid. So what I've done here, we're just going to look at three cities if we could. And I think we'll start with Eagan. If you could look at the fourth city down, I've got them in alphabetical order. And by the way, the levy and LGA numbers, I've got to give some credit here, came out of this publication from the LMC. They've got that September of every year. This is my Bible. It's got all sorts of great information, but it's kind of easy to quickly look at, so I have to give LMC some credit here. But that's where that information comes from. But you can see with Eagan, that does not get LGA. All of their levy, which would be $22 million, their levy in aid is $22 million also. But their 3% levy limit, if you go over to the fifth column, it would be, we're going to assume 3%. Let's just use a 3%. They would be able to raise their levy $669,000. Which, if you go to the next column, that's the full 3%. Levy limit. They would be able to go 3% of levy plus aid, because of course it's all in levy. They leave nothing on the table. The last column would be the revenue loss from being able to use 3% of levy plus aid, which has usually been happening in the past. So let's take Albert Lea up on the top. There with about $5.6 million LGA and $4 million in levy, the total levy plus aid is $9.6 million, and I would argue again that that's your total budget. That's the real number that's telling you what you're using. Under the governor's proposal, they would only be able to raise 3% of the 2007 levy, and that's of the $4 million. So that'd be $120,000, and that is only about 1.2% of levy plus aid. So you can see the difference between Eagan, where they're able to go 3% of levy plus aid or budget, and Albert Lea of 1.2. And the last column is what I'm saying that would be the revenue loss, is that of being able to use 3% of levy plus aid versus the current, where Albert Lea would really leave about $168,000 on the table. And I don't know if I have to go through any more, but you can see certainly, and I guess my question on this, Commissioner, is, you know, why not include, and I know you gave a little explanation, but why not include aid? Because this, you know, what we're dealing with are budgets that the idea of local government aid is the equalizer, in that you get that because you're property poor, and it's so that in the city of Dilworth, I shouldn't have to pay any more to feel safe in my home than someone who lives in Eagan.
and that's part of the budget. So I guess what would be the rationale to just take it off of levy? Because it looks like, you know, in Albert Lee here, it's a property poor district, and yet they're not going to be able to capture as much as a property rich district. And to me, it kind of looks like you're piling on these property poor cities. So you could respond, Commissioner.
Open here. You can't OD on Dayquil, can you? You got to take another Dayquil today. Chairman, you know, when we put together this levy limit proposal for the governor, it was really from the perspective of the taxpayer. We wanted to treat taxpayer, whether they resided in a aid-dependent community or not an aid-dependent community, kind of it's the same. So we decided to calculate it based on levy exclusively. You know, last year we came in and we talked about a levy limit that was not very well received by this committee, which really focused its attention, applied levy limits only to those cities that were heavily aid-dependent. And after having a discussion with this committee, we thought you guys made some very valid points. We thought, let's do something that applies to all communities. Treat the taxpayer put on even footing, whether they reside in Eagan or in Albert Lee or Rochester. So it really was from the perspective of the taxpayer to say, you know, 3% plus household growth, plus all the special levies, we thought was a reasonable place to put the levy limit in conjunction with the fact that we did not make any cuts to local government aid, no cuts to county aid. We thought that was, you know, we took that into consideration as part of the equation, that this levy limit was not overly onerous for aid-dependent cities or non-aid-dependent cities. So that was kind of the thought process, Chairman.
Well, I understand that, Commissioner, but just looking at levy, but I, you know, we're looking at, you know, the budgets, and what this would equate really is to a real revenue cut, especially for the property poor cities more. I mean, even outside just discussing levy limits, just kind of the way we're doing it would, I think, in looking at that last column, actually be revenue cuts. And you might as well take local government aid and make those cuts. And Albert Lee would be the same as almost making a cut of 168 and an 8. Because that, you're losing revenue capacity to raise. And it all, you know, the thing about property tax levies and aids is you're paying for services. And if you've got to, you know, even with the implicit price deflator of 5.45%, that's basically what it's costing cities and counties and local units of government to pay for their goods. So anything less than that 5.45 is really a cut in service quality. Because if you're going to keep the same service quality as the year before, you have to pay 5.45% more. If you don't have that or you pay less, you end up cutting. And that's why I think an approach like this might actually ultimately raise taxes rather than lower it, because when you have the levy limits, cities are very uncertain of kind of what this local-state relationship is. And so a lot of them, not knowing what's going to happen next year, is going to say, you know, we could keep our levy even down here, but I'm going to raise it to the max because who knows what's going to happen next year. And I think there's maybe evidence that that does occur. And the other thing is when you actually have to cut services, which if you can't at least get to implicit price deflator, you're cutting the same level of services. Now, you either cut services or find more efficiencies. You know, you can find more efficiencies, and that might work for a year, you know, squeeze out efficiencies, but ultimately, as this stays in place, you cut back on services. And when you cut back on services, you cut back on quality of life, and now people, it's not as attractive to live in that community. They move out of the community, and that raises property taxes for everyone else. You get to a spiral of poorer services, people moving out, spread more taxes on everyone else, and you end up paying more on this. So I just, levy limits aside, even just kind of the approach here of only putting on levy, I really think is putting a double hit on cities that are property poor, that rely on that aid, because I think that could be part of the mix. But I know there's some Representative Paymar, I think you've got.
I'm not sure. I just want to, looking at your chart, I just want some clarification here. So the impact of the governor's levy limit. So are you saying that my city will lose roughly $1,800,000 in revenue under the governor's proposal.
Here's what I'm saying is that, Representative Pimer, what would happen is normally if you would be able to levy, have a levy limit on levy plus aid versus just on levy, that's what you would lose under the proposal of just on levy rather than levy and aid. So those extra revenue, you're not going to be able to collect that under most levy limit scenarios you would be able to. And what I'm saying also is that basically your levy plus your aid is your budget. So we all have budgets. And because some communities are property rich and some property poor, that mix of the budget of the revenues, whether or not it's levy or aid, differs a little bit. But it's still your budget that you're working off of, that you fund your law enforcement and your fire department and your street department. And so as far as your budget, I'm saying what I'm alluding here to is that would be your loss under this, just going by levy rather than levy plus aid. Okay. Representative Demmer? I'm sorry, Representative Loeffler, and then we'll come back to...
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I agree with your analysis about this is about also service equalization, not just, you know, the impact on the taxpayer. But in addition to the service cut issue, you also have the issue of turning to much more regressive fees and other resources, trying to maintain a basic level of services, whether that's street lighting fees or whatever. Those tend to be incredibly recessive, and so regressive rather. And I think, you know, it puts communities that tend to have, if you have lower tax base, you tend to have people of lower income generally, and then so they're less able to, where at least if it's on the property tax base, you know, we do have, you know, our circuit breaker and other things that help people deal with the shifts and the cost of city government as well. I'm hoping at some point we can look at this as well for counties and the impacts on that, because there we have another factor coming in, not as much an issue on cities because the cities took their big hit with federal revenue sharing some time ago, but with the counties, as of March 3rd, this new targeted case management went into effect. They tried in the Senate to put it off for a year, but the House being fiscally responsible and saying, pay as you go, we can't come up with the money, according to their theory. But for Minnesota to lose $60 to $100 million in child protection aid, I just don't think there's a heartless county board, no matter how fiscally conservative they are, that aren't going to try and step up to make sure that that kind of protection is there for their youngest residents. And so I think there's some other things going on that I think when we look at this whole impact and what's there and what do we really want in our service system, I think we need to look at it all. But I do think shifting everything back to, you know, fees and other things isn't the way to go either.
Representative Demmer, who I'm going to call on next, has to be out of here by 8 o'clock tonight. Because his Hayfield girls basketball team is in the semifinals against Albany.
They are.
So I'm hoping this discussion will end by 8.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, by 7:30, Mr. Chair. The game starts at 8, Mr. Chair. I got to be there at 7:30. That's even cutting it short. That's giving very minimal time for popcorn.
Commissioner, keep your answers a little shorter then, because we're going to be right up against the time.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So,
I appreciate it.
Representative Demmer.
And the Vikings, go Vikings. Let's just say it that way. Mr. Chair, I gotta just comment on the perspective of the way the numbers are labeled. The revenue loss, Mr. Chair, is not really a revenue loss. That would be a 3%. That would be the 3% increase in LGA that would be more of an opportunity cost, if you will. Assuming that what that is, what that number is in that right column, it says revenue loss. It's really 3% of the LGA if they increased LGA. Because actually, for example, Representative Paymar's district, in St. Paul, his city, actually would be gaining $2.15 million by levying 3% increase on their levy. So he's not really losing 1.8 unless you say not being able to raise LDA 3% is a loss. So this is an example, Mr. Chair, where because I'm not raising something, I'm calling it a loss. And so I think it's just for a disclosure. I understand what you're doing, and if you read it carefully, it says from a 3% increase on levy and LGA, But again, if somebody just looks at revenue loss, it'd be very easy to say, oh, my city's losing $1.8 million? This is bad. Well, it just means opportunity cost, the way I'm seeing this, Mr. Chair. He's actually looking at increasing their levy by $2.1 million, but then obviously if they would have got a 3% increase on their LDA, they would have got another $1.8 million. So I think it really has to be careful how we term this, because it could be misconstrued. Am I right on that?
Yeah, and Representative Demmer, I understand that. It might be better to phrase that as budget loss or something, because the idea is, and if you go to that second or the last column, levy limit as percent levy plus aid, my point is the levy plus aid tends to be your budget. And that's what funds, and so where Albert Lee would only be able to raise 1.2% of their budget in the levy limits, the more property rich district could get as close to 3%. So I will give you that. The better term might be a budget loss. I'm trying to relate to the budget, which that's what you're dealing with, is the money. You know, if you've got a budget and I have a budget, how we bring our money in may differ, but if that's still the budget we're operating off, and then someone says, okay, you can only raise it off only what you made on your birthday cards that you brought in on your birthday, you can only raise it creates some problems here.
If I could, Mr. Chair,
go ahead, Representative Demmer.
Another way to phrase that last column is the amount of the decrease of the increase.
Representative Demmer, we certainly could discuss that. You know, one other point on this is that it does delink LGA from your property taxes. So if, for example, if you were to lose because the volatility or other factors would lower your LGA, you don't have the ability to recoup that either. So if you would have, through no fault of your own, because of the volatility in your system, because it's really delinked, if you were to have a cut in local government aid, that would be a double hit, because you don't have the capacity here to make up for that. So I mean, that's another problem that you would have with just going off of the levies here, I think.
Chairman, hopefully we've mitigated some of that by the volatility fix that was in the bill that passed. We'll try to hopefully mitigate some of that year-to-year fluctuations in the LJ revenue. But you know, I want to reiterate that this levy limit proposal, we don't believe is onerous. I mean, if this had been in effect, as I said before, if this had been in effect for taxes payable this year, the levy limit would have gone, or the net aggregate property tax increase would have gone from 7.3% to 5.4%. I mean, 5.4% property tax growth is fairly healthy. And when homeowners and taxpayers are struggling, they're assuming a lot of other housing-related costs, I think this is a reasonable way of tamping down some of the more egregious increases. You know, we still allow for household growth. We still allow for all the special levies that have previously been in traditional levy limits. And we allow for the lesser of 3% or the implicit price deflator. So it's not unreasonable. It allows for growth. It's not a hard freeze. And if you have a compelling case in your community and you want to exceed the levy limit, you have a tool to do that. You can take it to your voters and say, you know, we have a compelling need in this area. Give us a affirmative vote, and you can exceed the levy limit by any amount you want. So I don't think this is onerous. I do think the traditional levy limits in the past were to the point where they're almost meaningless, because they were stole for it with, you know, household growth and a certain percentage of commercial industrial growth. And so I think they were good window dressing in a lot of respects, but they weren't real and they weren't meaningful to the taxpayer. This at least will provide some security for the taxpayer without being a net cut or a hard freeze or anything like that. So we think it sets a reasonable balance in conjunction, like I said before, with we're not cutting any local government aid and county aid.
And as stated on the onset, we appreciate that. And Commissioner, as you talk about the numbers and overall what it would have decreased and so forth, you're looking overall, and I'm still saying that in this you're treating cities differently, and you are putting some cities under a lot more hardship in comparison to the budgets than others. And that's a real concern here. As I look at this, I think property poor districts, without a doubt, is going to have a lot tighter squeeze on them than a property rich district. And I
I just think when you look at this as a percent of budgets, that's going to happen. And, you know, and you're saying this is different from past levy limits, and it is. And I think when you look at levy limits in the past, and I talked about this on the House floor, you could argue whether or not they are effective. And I, you know, you look at the stats since the Minnesota Miracle in 1971, since 37 years since then, 27 of the years we've had levy limits and 10 we have not. And of those 27 that we did, the average increase, now granted, it doesn't include all the cities and there's other things, but just overall property taxes, in those 27 levy limit years, the increase was average was 5.4%. But if you took out 2 years, which was 1972, right after the Minnesota Miracle, where it really dropped, or 2002, after the reform, where it really dropped, if you took those 2 years out, in those 25 years, it actually was a 6.6% increase in statewide property taxes under levy limits. And under the years that we didn't have levy limits, 10 years, the average was 6.3% growth. And only one of those 10 years where you did not have levy limits did you exceed 10% or more in 1 year. And in six times out of the 27, you went over 10% when you had levy limits. So I think maybe over 1 year you can drop down, but over time, because of this uncertainty in state and local relationships, you're raising them. I know that looking at research that bond ratings can go down for cities if they don't have the capacity to raise revenues. And that ultimately would increase interest costs, which would raise property taxes. And just even this fact that you have to cut back on services, especially in a lot of these property-poor cities already in communities, that could be the death knell for a lot of these communities. And you have citizens leaving, and that raises taxes on everyone else. So I don't know long-term if they do what we want. And then, well, we haven't even discussed local control as far as an issue. But Representative Earhart, you've been waiting patiently.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We have a phenomenon going on which we haven't had for a great many years, if ever, and that is the reduction in the market value of residential properties right now. And has that been taken into consideration in either aid or levy limit? Because there are some areas that have, you could give them the same levy that they had last year, then they couldn't raise as much money because their residential properties are reduced 3%, 4%, and 5%. So what are we doing about that?
Commissioner.
Chairman, Representative Earhart, under this levy limit proposal, decline in market valuations would not have an impact. And they could still levy whatever they levied the previous year plus whatever the inflation provision and CPI. So that wouldn't have an impact. And but your point is well taken in this respect, is that one of the reasons why we think this levy limit is reasonable and the right thing to do from the state perspective is that we are in extenuating circumstances right now with the housing market. We are in economically troubled times, and even if this ends up only being a temporary levy limit over for a couple of years, we think, to your point, Chairman, I think long term there is an open question about whether levy limits really do what they were intended to do. But we are in extenuating circumstances right now, so we think at minimum this levy limit should be in place for a little time to provide a little bit of a reprieve and a little protection to the taxpayer during this economically troubling time. So, you know, if I'm gonna weigh in on the side of either the local unit of the government or the taxpayer at this point, I'm gonna err on the side of the taxpayer at this point. I think that's where the governor came out, that, you know, this could be a little bit of a squeeze for some of those, especially those aid-dependent communities, some of those with not a lot of property tax base. It could be somewhat of a squeeze. But if you had to choose at this point between protecting taxpayers or putting a little bit of a squeeze on some local units of government, this administration and this government are on the side of the taxpayer. And that's kind of what we came down with this levy limit.
Well, Mr. Chairman,
Representative Earhart.
But there's no significant change in the aid. There's not going to be a change in the aid to help out those cities that are...
That's correct. That's Chairman, okay. Representative Earhart.
Yes, there, Commissioner.
Yeah, but I think the point has already been made by both the chairman and myself that, you know, where a lot of parts of the budget are taking substantial reductions, the one area that was held harmless was local government aid, county aid. And that was a recognition that they are they're going to struggle. And it was also recognition of this levy limit. If we're going to put a meaningful levy limit in, we couldn't cut their aid at the same time. We didn't think that was reasonable, especially aid that's going out this year where they've already set their budget. They've already made a determination what their levy is going to be. We didn't think that was a reasonable way to go in the context of this budget. But we did not increase aid. We also did not reduce them. And a lot of our other areas of the budget would have appreciated being treated in that way. So, reasonable.
Representative Loeffler.
Well, Mr. Chairman, and just to that point, though, at least the counties, which get most of their state aid and budgets other than the ones in front of this committee, that's not true. And, you know, I mean, the county program aid was held harmless, but other things that play into most of the mandated services that counties have to do, including, you know, I see the short-term offenders here. That wasn't held harmless. And so at least for one of the three branches of a local government, the freeze on AIDS just didn't follow through, and yet they're still subject to the levy limit.
Chairman, Representative Loeffler.
Yes, Commissioner.
Point well taken. I mean, there's a county aid program, but I do know that Health Human Services budget has all kinds of programs that pass through to the counties, and many of those were not held harmless.
Correct.
This division has worked very hard the last couple of years in looking at ways to provide property tax relief. We had some pretty significant property tax relief plans last year. And the one thing is that when you do put a squeeze on local units of government, you put a squeeze on taxpayers. They're not separate entities. They're all one. And so, because you know, when you put a squeeze on cities or counties, that's a squeeze on your taxpayer, either in decreased services or, you know, increase in taxes or whatever. And so when we talk about levy limits, I don't think we can separate the two between local units of government and taxpayers, because if in fact, you know, to me, property tax relief is reducing taxes while keeping the same level of services. That's property tax relief. Because we can cut services. We can cut police departments and lower property taxes, but to me that's not property tax relief, because you're cutting services. And so though the citizen's getting less, paying less, but getting less. So for me, property tax relief is paying less, but maintaining the same level of service. And that's my real concern with levy limits, is that you have a resident getting top-notch services at, you know, roughly the same, at a good affordable cost. And and I know we're in the same boat on that, but I don't think you can separate and say we're going to err on one side or the other, because, you know, our local units of government are our taxpayers. And I don't think we can separate those. And cities that receive local government aid, that is greatly benefiting the taxpayer. So there tends to be a separation from that. This LG is impersonal, and it funds city halls, but it doesn't fund city halls. It funds services to our residents. So this has been great discussion. Does anyone else have any other comments? Representative Brown.
Chairman Burt and members, I just really appreciate the discussion that we are having about this proposal, especially, when I looked through the forms initially, there's Albert Lee, and that $168,000 is really important to us, and I can't help but feel that this proposal would tie their hands to do the work that they need to do. And so I especially appreciate your comments and kind of clarifying what's happening here and making that connection between the state and the local government. We do have this tendency to want to pay less and less at a state level, but then not allow our local governments to raise the revenue that they need to do. So I just really appreciate the discussion.
There has been a very good discussion. Representative Dietrich.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would just like to piggyback on what the chairman was saying. The work that we've done in the past in the area of property tax relief, we've tried to have two guiding principles. First is that it was meaningful property tax relief, and it was straight to the homeowner. And I don't know, by looking at some of these numbers, how much they would meet, how much value they represent to the average homeowner. And I would add one other principle, is that last year our proposal had to do with ability to pay, income. And so taking this approach, at least for me, doesn't hit those three guiding principles. And I don't think it's meaningful enough, and I don't think it's directly to the homeowner, meaningful enough directly to the homeowner. And it doesn't have anything to do with ability to pay.
Chairman, Representative Dietrich, this we're not holding this out as an ambitious property tax reform proposal. I'll stipulate to that right now. If we had more revenue on the table, if we had a better budgetary situation, we would have embraced those principles in this proposal. The administration was a big fan of Chairman Marcourt's proposal that came out here, heavily reliant on the PTR, direct property tax relief to those most in need, expanding that. I think we called it a table charge PTR.
Mitchell, you called it that. We had the home for credit state refund, but I like that too. We might have to work on that.
Really?
I like that. It does have a little more pizzazz.
There's a lot about that proposal we like, but of course that proposal takes a lot of dollars in order to do that, and we just don't have the resource on the table. So what we try to address, on the margins at least, is to tamp down some of the property tax increases, address some areas like the transitional aid for utilities, some areas of the squeaky wheel. Some of these areas are having some issues. So believe me, we don't hold this out as an ambitious property tax reform proposal. This levy limit, if it had been in effect, 60% of the benefit would have accrued to homeowners. So it does, it would have had some impact on homeowners, but all taxpayers would have benefited through it. It's not as targeted as we would have liked in an ideal world with more resources available. Absolutely right. We would have liked a more targeted, more comprehensive approach. But with what we had to work with, we think we did a pretty adequate job with what we had to work with.
Representative Dietrich.
So are you suggesting we resubmit our proposal and it would not be vetoed this year?
Chairman,
Commissioner,
I think everything should be on the table. Absolutely do.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I come from into this debate from a different perspective. My community does not receive any LGA whatsoever, and some of the proposals that have been put out there in the past to look at increasing income taxes, and that would be a hit on the people in my district, and they're frustrated because they're seeing their property taxes increase year after year. And they're getting shit from other sides for paying for all these other things that we have going on here at the legislature. And it's frustrating for them. Plus, they're facing challenges as far as the economy with the job market. I have Northwest Airline pilots that are concerned about their job security. I have folks that were impacted by the Macy's closure, and a whole host of other employees that are facing tough times because of the downturn in the economy. And so when I look at this as, I look at this as an option for us, considering that we are $935 million in the hole, at least that we'd be able to get some relief to the people. And I like that it's, a direct relief, I feel, to people in my district. So I think this is a good start, and I look forward to having more conversations about how we can get relief to our constituents. And I want to help you guys as much as my district, but, I want it to be fair, and I feel in the past things have not been overly fair.
Thank you for those comments. And Ms. Nines and Mr. Manson, I appreciate it. I'm going to give you the last word. Comment.
Chairman, nothing more to say other than the fact that we look forward to working with you and your division and the whole tax committee in putting together a reasonable, hopefully we can deliver some property tax relief. Primarily the homeowners, and I look forward to working with you, Chairman.
So, thank you so much for being here. Good luck to Hayfield tonight, and a great weekend to everyone. We are adjourned.